Ah, wow. Having taught in China myself and seen some of these issues unfolding, I think that was really brilliant, very perceptive and insightful, especially your comparisons. So thank you very much. And now I can't wait to hear what Dr. Crouch has to say, so please come on up, Christopher.
Thanks for coming along. I'm going to be crossing some of the material and ideas that Lenore has been talking about, but probably coming at it from a slightly different direction. We've used the same philosophers, we've used the same writers, and we've used the same artwork, but kind of hopefully it won't just be duplication. What I want to look at, first of all, can everybody hear me? No? Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think I'm going to be able to keep this up, but I shall do my very best. What I want to look at is the way in which industrialization and, by the very nature, industrialization is modernity, transformed the set of traditional cultural values that were rooted in China and rooted in a rural and agricultural way of living. And it's that process of industrialization that I'm going to take as key. That's the process that I'm going to say ruptured and disassembled tradition, which has led to the kind of debates that are now in China about what is Chineseness. Now, I've been working there 10 years. I still don't understand it. It's an incredibly opaque society. And one of the reasons that it's opaque, I'll touch on briefly. And it's because it's opaque to the Chinese, and because contemporary Chinese sociologists and artists and intellectuals and writers and philosophers have such a problem articulating what is going on in China, I'm making no claims that I know. I'm just positioning myself as a visitor that comes and goes and has some kind of insight into what is going on. Above and beyond that, I'm making no claims. Let's think about the issue that Lenore identified, which is this one that what we think of as contemporary art and is often referred to as avant-garde art in China. Why is it so problematic in China? Because, as she said, most Chinese academics, intellectuals, members of the burgeoning middle class, they're not particularly interested in what we think is this fantastic outpouring of creativity in China. Lots of them think it's trash. Now, why is that? There's a reason for that. It's not just, although part of it is the idea that it represents Western values, that's really party members would kind of have a problem with that, and party members of a certain age. But it goes deeper. It's more fundamental than that, I think. And I think we can see this embodied in the story of High Panda by the artist Gigi, who then turned himself into a fashion entrepreneur. He started his career in a spectacular way. He was chosen to be part of the China Design Now show that was in the V&A in London, a huge review of art and design in China. And he did a sculpture of a panda holding a rocket. And it was quite cute. It was okay. The People's Choice. Do you have the People's Choice here where the audience goes into a gallery and they sort of leave a little note saying, I thought number two was the best. So by the end of the show, the People's Choice said, oh, we love the panda with the rocket. The panda was great. He went back to China and he built an empire, a commercial empire, design empire, based on this. So Angry Panda, Grumpy Panda, I think, and Injured Panda, And of course, they're a parody of Hello Kitty. Do I need to explain Hello Kitty? No. Okay, good. So there are some transnational forms of communication. So Hello Kitty is one of them. So it started off as a critique. It started off as a kind of ironic play with the signifiers of what is Chinese, the panda, kind of how we communicate internationally. And it went from a critique into a business opportunity. Because he realized that... Engage. Thank you. Thank you. I only do that once, but it's always worth doing. And those of you that don't know Star Trek will have missed that, but never mind. He started to play with the idea of using this signifier of a panda as a way of being hip. And suddenly we're in this space that Lenore was talking about, where irony is really difficult, because irony just turns into kind of a very prosaic kind of awfulness after a while. And this is what happened to Hi Panda. He started to make some T-shirts in Shanghai, and they started to get bought by Chinese musicians, largely Chinese hip-hop musicians. And they became incredibly fashionable as a countercultural signifier in China. One of the executives from Louis Vuitton, which is one of the European fashion houses, was in China looking for business opportunities and saw a Hi Panda T-shirt, contacted Gigi, and signed him up to distribute all the goods in Europe. In France, this is the difference between the French and the British, by the way. In France, they opened the line at the Palais de Tokyo, which is the incredibly groovy, funky, kind of uber-cool art gallery in Paris. They had a fantastic party. All the Parisian intelligentsia were there along with their artists and some of the cooler politicians. In Britain, though, they went straight to a shop, Harvey Nicks, which is a very upmarket shop. And even the idea of having a panda that was saying hi was a bit too radical for the British. So the panda says hello now. Hello, I'm Panda. And just in case a panda is a little too confronting, they dressed him up in as many possible ways as to kind of bland him out as possible. So what started off as this radical kind of intervention into the way in which culture signifies internationally became absorbed by that industrial modernist system that he actually set out to critique. And that really, kind of, if we think of that as the model of what's happening to traditional culture in China, that's a way of conceiving it. There's another point about the panda. My panda sculptures attracted the attention of Western fashion icons in 2008 because of the lack of new artwork there caused by the economic turmoil. Also, foreign customers love my panda since it is the symbol of China. Two things going on here. Firstly, we must remember that China constitutes 1/6 of the world. There are 1 billion people there. It owns most of the foreign debts of most of the industrialized countries in the West. Its industry is booming. Its economy is growing roughly 10% a year. The rest of the world, industrialized world, is in recession. At the moment, whether we like it or not, China is the economic powerhouse of the world, and it's using its soft power, it's using its economic power to kind of spread its cultural influence through things like the Confucius Institute. So that's the first thing. Here's someone in China going, oh, look, I went to Europe and gee whiz, it was bad. And kind of one of the reasons I was so successful is that everything there is just really poor. One important cultural piece of information there. The other is that this realization that everybody in the West thinks of the panda as being Chinese. This is an invention of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the 70s, where they suddenly realized that one of the ways in which they could court the West was by giving their zoos pandas. And suddenly the panda became this symbol of China. But it's a it's a modernist symbol of China. It's an invention of the mass media and mass communications. So what then, if the panda doesn't represent China, what are the traditions of China? Well, I think there are three key ones that we need to think about. One, we've just been hearing unfold, and that's Confucianism. There is Buddhism, it goes back to the 3rd century. Confucius, let me check, I can't remember dates, I'm shocking. 5th century BC. So Confucius goes back to the 5th century BC. We must also remember that China is the longest running political entity in the world. So the Chinese state, the unified Chinese state, is kind of a substantial contribution to global stability in some ways. And the tradition that I want to focus on and kind of suggest is one of the ways in which we can understand Chinese tradition is that of Taoism. Now, when Shenzhou painted this in the 15th century, he was trying to re-establish a tradition that he thought had faded away. So that's how long we must think about traditional ways of thinking about the world in China. And what is interesting about Taoism for me is that it's rooted in the idea of being unified with nature and conceiving of human endeavors and the human self as being integrated harmoniously and in a unified way with the natural world. So it involves an engagement with nature at every level, at the most profoundest level and at the level of having fun and just enjoying the world. It involves a system of representing the world in which we have a sense of verticality. And we have verticality because at the top of the mountain is where the intellect resides. At the foot of the mountain, where there are waters, that's where the practicality and the energies of human consciousness come from. So it's a world, or rather, paintings are a way of encompassing both the world and the way that we think about the world. Now, this runs through Chinese culture for centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries. So for the purposes of this next half hour, or the next 20 minutes, this is what we're going to concentrate on. This tradition of painting nature and the way in which it was painted by what are called scholar painters. These weren't commercial artists. These weren't artists who made a living from painting. These were artists who went into nature to escape the kind of corruption of the court, to escape the corruption of the material world, and find some kind of release and some engagement with the wider world. The painted landscape, we've already seen how they painted landscape, a set of very carefully coded brush marks. Different brush marks were used to convey different things, to convey different moods. So it's a way of thinking about the world that is carefully codified. And it's passed on. It's the Chinese tradition. Jean Cocteau tells a story about trying to encapsulate the essence of Chinese culture. Jean Cocteau was a French poet. He tells the story of travellers in China, in modern China, who had a hole in the petrol compartment thing in their cars. I can't think of the word. Somebody help me.
Yes. Gas tank.
Thank you. There's a hole in the gas tank. So they took it to a local blacksmith and they said, look, can you reproduce this? And he went, of course. And they went back the next morning and he gave them a freshly made gas tank complete with a hole in it. So this idea of repetition, learning through assimilating what's there and repeating it is central to Chinese culture. And this, of course, is how traditions work. It's industrialization and modernity that has disrupted this kind of relationship with knowledge and how knowledge is embodied in the individual and passed down. This is important later on in the lecture. Thank you. And we must remember, of course, that not all traditions are benign. Some traditions are horrendous. And sort of traditional attitudes to women, kind of things like foot binding, explains why one of Mao's most popular policies was women hold up half the sky. So traditions in themselves aren't necessarily good, but traditions exist, and we can understand cultures and societies through their traditions. And another tradition that runs through Chinese culture that goes back to the second century is that of the legalists. Now, the legalists were an extreme version of Confucianism. Confucianism is about harmony in the secular and civic and social realm. It has other kind of manifestations, but fundamentally what differentiates Confucianism from Taoism is that Confucianism is about social and civic exchange, whereas Taoism is about a much bigger harmony with nature. The legalists were a kind of functionist version of Confucianists who said everybody must obey the law. No matter how small, everybody must obey the law, otherwise we don't have order. And any kind of transgression of the law resulted in beheading. Now, this kind of absolute, this sense of the absolute nature of civic law, of course, is a tradition in China that has manifested itself in all kinds of ways. For example, Tiananmen. This, again, is a way of behaving and thinking about the world. Thank you. So what's our problem? Well, the problem is that rural life, essentially the cornerstone of traditional Chinese culture, is being eradicated. And it's being eradicated at lightning speed. What took 200 years in Europe to slowly kind of fade away has happened in 15 years in China, effectively. This is Shenzhen. This is a city that's 30 years old. 30 years ago, this was a little fishing town. It's now population of 10 million. So this is how rapidly Chinese culture is changing. This is how rapidly traditional values and traditional ways of thinking about the world are being taken away from those who have grown up with them. So if we think about Lenore's party official, I don't know how old he was, kind of. Yeah, so 39, yeah, okay. my name is Patsy Stone and I'm 39. Does anybody know Ab Fab here? Yes, thank you, okay. A depressing amount of my life, obviously, spent quoting from a television program. So, you can imagine then, someone who's grown up in a China in which tradition has been questioned, but still central, is completely disorientated by this new world. And they see industrialization as a manifestation of Western culture sweeping through China, sort of washing everything away. This is Chongqing. I work at a university, Southwest University, on the outskirts of Chongqing. Chongqing has a municipal population of 30 million. So you could fit the entire population of Australia into the municipality of Chongqing, and you would still have 9 million people, sort of space for 9 million people. Huge, huge cities, huge kind of urban environments. What space is there in a physical environment like this for traditional values to continue? Here's a way of conceiving what's happening. This is the dam at the end of the Yangtze River. This great dam is the world's largest hydroelectric power station. Because, of course, China is making all these things for us. It's making all these kind of iPhones and whatever kind of consumer culture wants. Where are they being made? They're being made in China. Where are they getting their energy from? Well, they have to generate it somehow. They know that they've got a looming environmental problem, so they're trying to diversify their energy production into non-polluting energy. So this is one of the contributions. It's massive. $22 million to build it. The Yangtze River, Chongqing is a kind of towards, is in the mountains towards the source of the Yangtze. The Yangtze River traditionally was a trading river. Lots and lots of different minority cultures with traditional ways of life trading on this river. By damming it at the end, it's meant that those communities have had to relocate. And it's not as if the Gestapo goes in there and says, you will relocate now, get your belongings and flee. Kind of the government has a relocation project to try and solve this problem, where villages and towns are being rebuilt up the side of mountains. But of course, nobody wants to go and live there. If they're going to live in a grotty town, they might as well go and live in the nearest city, Chongqing. So over 1 million residents relocated during this period. And it's a sore issue. Here's a painting by one of my students in China, a Chinese student of mine, Wang Xuning. And high dams make a great lake. And in making that great lake, there is a whole dispossessed set of people. And if we think of this at a bigger level, what we have are a dispossessed traditional culture. Culture is kind of moving away from its source in the same way that the people who practice that traditional culture are. Thank you. So let's ravel back again. Let's go back to the sort of beginning of the 20th century when China was still a rural community, still a traditional community, beginning to industrialize slowly. And you have intellectuals like Lu Xun, who are vigorously opposed to tradition because they see tradition as getting in the way of modernizing China. Intellectuals at this time wanted China to be new. They wanted it to compete with, for example, Japan. Everybody in China looked at Japan as this miracle of how traditional culture transformed itself by adopting Western ways. And Lu Xun wrote a very famous passage that started, "Imagine an iron house without windows. Imagine this house completely sealed and there's a fire in it and people are asleep and you know that they're going to die. What do you do? Do you wake them up? Do you go, oh no, there's a fire in the house, but you can't escape. Ah, you're all going to die." He saw it as a hopeless task, trying to get people to break traditional practices and to embrace the modern world. So he became a bit of an icon, particularly as a modernizer. He became a bit of an icon for the communist movement in China in the 40s. At the end of his life, he'd had enough of everybody, and he was a cantankerous, miserable person, apparently. He's a brilliant writer, but kind of he's not a particularly lovable human being. But he became a very important sort of intellectual source where people would return to and they would say, we need to modernize, we need to break tradition. And all the time, Lu Xun would be the man to be quoted. Go and read him. Go and read Lu Xun. His brilliant insights into the way that we need to modernize. So he got taken out of context in the Cultural Revolution in the late 60s, petered out in the early 70s. And this is a poster. Actually, we'll talk about that in a moment. It's an image that reinforces the idea of smashing the four olds. Now, this was a part of the modernizing campaign of the Cultural Revolution in the 60s. Smash the four olds. And the four olds were old ideas, old culture, old customs, old habits. And the idea was that you would smash the four olds and replace them with the four news. And those four news would be new habits, customs, ways of thinking that would embrace industrialization, embrace modernity. Here is a transitional point. People often throw their hands up about the Cultural Revolution, and rightly so. But in terms of rupturing tradition, the Cultural Revolution did nothing compared to what contemporary consumer capitalism has done. This is a woodcut. It's a traditional way of making art. You have a big stack of paper, a really sharp knife, and you cut away, and you end up not with one image, but a dozen, two dozen, three dozen, depending on how skilled you are. So it's a traditional form of communication, but the content is radical. The content is arguing for newness. Same here. Here's a painting from the Cultural Revolution that uses the traditional forms of brush and ink painting, again, to convey this new message about the new world. You have to industrialize. Here's an attempt to synthesize old and new in a new way of thinking about the world. Brush and ink painting has never gone away. You might think when you look at contemporary, the way in which contemporary Chinese art is reported in the West, you might well think that no one paints in a brush and ink manner. But if you go to any contemporary art show in any large city, Chongqing, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Beijing, Shandong, anywhere that you want, you will find the predominant art that is in museums is brush and ink. And it will take varying forms. And one way in which it can be talked about is the idea of new scholar painting. There's actually a term, new scholar painting. The idea that these traditions can be reinvented. And how are they reinvented? Well, Huang Binhong here, who moved from, or lived throughout those tumultuous kind of periods of industrialization, talked about tracing the past in order to create the future. And to the kind of unfamiliar eye, you could look at this and go, well, it's just like every other brush and ink painting that's ever been made in 2,000 years. What's the big deal about this? Well, the big deal is, as was pointed out in the previous talk, brush and ink painting has a set of incredibly precise brush codes. And what Huang decided to do was to ignore all those and just paint as he wanted to. He's going to use a brush and ink just however it happens, kind of totally intuitively, totally organically, kind of progress the idea of a Taoist engagement with nature and materials and just let it just flow out. And we can see this even in contemporary brush and ink work, where the discipline, if you like, the discipline of tradition, and sometimes this offends sort of those older brush and ink artists who spent kind of 15 years of their life sleeping under a table in their master's studio in order to learn the many different ways of using the brush, to suddenly see someone come along like this and go, la, 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 and there's a tree there, and there's a house. But it doesn't warm itself necessarily to traditionalists, but nevertheless, it is a vital and growing and engaging practice. When people go to an art gallery and they want to see modern painting, they want to see this. Thank you. So when we see contemporary artists playing with those traditional forms, how do we read them? Is this an embracing of tradition, or is this an ironic kind of disengagement with it? Now, depending on your position, if we're a kind of wealthy businessman in any of the kind of economic centres of the Western world, you look at this, you go, ha, that's cool, I'll buy that. And kind of don't really have any idea what's going on there. Like, it's quite good. So that, like, it's an image on somebody's face. So, like, it's a trope. You can pick it up everywhere. There are a billion people in China. Even if only 1% of those were artists, and even if only sort of half of that 1% kind of had an imagination, that would leave an awful lot of people making pictures for the Western market in which they do things to their face. Oh, I'll cover it with rice, or I'll put characters on it, or I'll paint on it, or I'll paint it red or green or I'll cover it with mud. There's just the meme of the Chinese artist's face covered with stuff is huge. How do we make sense of it? If we were someone who understood the complexities of traditional art making in China, and we'd grown up with those images, an understanding of the complex relationship of us, a painted image, the artist's expression and what they were painting, and then went to look at this. This is just crass. This is just absurd stupidity. It's kind of like the equivalent of my little Johnny could paint that. I don't know what somebody told me what the American idiom is for that. My kid could do that. That's kind of, my kid could do that. In fact, when they go to the local fair at the shopping mall at the start of every month, they have a face painting booth. And you've got lots of little kids looking like zombies or tigers and things. What's the difference between that and this? That would be the sort of response of someone embedded in that traditional cultural practice. Now, having set up that sort of dynamic relationship, or I hope I set up that dynamic relationship between an embedded traditional set of practices and industrialization coming along like a tractor and kind of plowing everything up and kind of churning everything up, let's have a look at the ways in which there are traces of traditional practice that are revealed in the art that is being made for affluent Westerners. Because that's what we see. That contemporary art that we see is made for the Western art market. It's not made for a domestic art market. But let's see how they play with these ideas. Sorry, yes, don't. Cancel that command number one. Rocks. Rocks are a really important part of traditional culture because they stand in for landscape. So we have rocks that stand in for landscape, and then we have rocks that are expressive, rocks that have certain qualities. We have stripy rocks, we have slim rocks, and we have tower rocks, which are rocks with holes in, you can see through. I was first introduced to rocks by a party of art students when I was in Guangzhou, teaching at the art school at Sun Yat-sen. And they said, oh, let's all go down to the art gallery. So we all went down to the art gallery, and they're all rushing off to see what was then a very fashionable sculpture of a huge dinosaur, a dinosaur about as big as this room, painted pink in a cage. And they were like, oh, that's so cool. They're all running around, getting really excited, everybody taking photographs of it. And we were going in, and there was all kind of these rocks on things. And I said to them, what are these? They said, I don't know. They're just old rocks, I think. And like, let's go and see the dinosaur. So I came back, and I thought, this is really curious. Kind of, those rocks looked hideous. And then I discovered that when the first Christian missionaries saw the rock gardens of China, they kind of thought they were made of pig bones, and that they were the work of the devil. So anybody coming from a Western aesthetic sensibility, these are ugly, but they have their qualities. So this tower rock is a rock with holes in. And this is a very good one. So here's a painting. Do you know this? Do you know Yu's work? He sells for, I think, the last one that went on the market in Hong Kong. It was a picture of these smiling people with some cranes. I think that sold for $2.5 million. So he's big business. Big business. And here he's got some of his ubiquitous smiling people crawling out of a rock. Wang Jian. He's made a huge business creating artificial shiny rocks. Shiny things. Shiny things always make things better. So he's created a whole business making these. Either for art biennales, or you can get them scaled for your own home, or a shopping mall. So here's that tradition, that incredibly intense tradition of trying to find beauty in nature, trying to find a way of understanding our emotional and physical engagement with the natural world, being reduced industrially to a whole load of shiny things. You saw this at the start of the last talk. Zhang's huge sculpture of Confucius that was shown at shown in Shanghai last year. It's massive, and there's a mechanism inside Confucius' chest so that he's breathing. So you're there, and he's kind of slowly breathing. We already know the significance of the breath. We already know that, or we can also perhaps guess at the significance of water. Water is at the base of mountains. Water is about practicality. This is Confucius, who is this eminent practitioner of harmoniousness. Now, why has the Chinese state suddenly engaged with Confucius? They spent all their time during the Cultural Revolution saying, criticize Lin Piao, criticize Confucius, because they promoted a stable kind of traditional view of human relationships. And in a revolutionary environment, kind of, that's not what you want. You want change. Suddenly, industrialization has swept Chinese society. Traditional values have been uprooted. People no longer have bodies of social codes to which they kind of adhere. And suddenly Confucius is back in fashion. Here is this body of thought that says, we need a harmonious society, we need to work together. Now this combined, this kind of reinvention of Confucius as a philosopher who is fundamental to understanding Chineseness also coincides with the 11th five-year plan in 2008, where the Chinese government suddenly realized that as people left the rural communities, handcrafts like paper cuts, embroidery, wood carving, ivory carving, those skills were being lost. They weren't being passed on. So they encouraged, they spent huge amounts of money, vast amounts of money, probably, so much, if it was all in here we couldn't count it. I don't actually know. But proportionally, it was a lot of money for teaching traditional practices in high schools, for teaching traditional practices in primary schools, and for engaging with UNESCO and trying to establish what they called intangible cultural heritage. So whole villages would be identified by UNESCO teams as having a skill that was kind of unduplicated anywhere in the world. And as soon as UNESCO said, yes, this is a unique contribution to world culture, the Chinese government would then pump loads and loads of money into that rural area to try and keep it stable so that those skills were maintained. Thank you. Another example of Confucianism at work, the red table, Confucius's red table, where the master would sit and pupils would come to learn from Confucius. This is the Leadership Academy in Shanghai. This is the elite school where the party cadres go to learn how to manage a new industrial China. And there, embedded in the architecture of the institute is Confucius's red table. Let's have another look at the way that tradition has been kind of reduced into a mockery. Let's have a look at the roof that has that form. So it's good feng shui form because it means that bad spirits, when they land on the roof, just go, whoa, and they're off again. They can't get into your house. Let's look at the tiles. Tiles are all round. They represent money. They represent good fortune. They represent wealth. Let's see how it's been used in contemporary industrial architecture. This is the Ministry of Communications building, which is basically just a high-rise building with some Chinese roofs plonked on the top like kind of hats. Yes, it's traditional. Put a roof on it. And this is in Chongqing. This is high-rise traditional Chinese architecture. This is a shopping mall. It's vast. Perhaps we can work out how many stories it is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. A dozen or so stories high. This is on the side of a mountain. Absolutely ludicrous. Kind of the most absurd, vulgar thing you've ever seen in your life. where a design form, a wooden house, that served perfectly valid, functional design purposes, has simply been taken as a stylistic decoration and piled on top of one another like Lego. And then everyone goes, oh, look, it's so traditional. I was with a family who were kind enough to take me there, and we were going to go and eat in the food hall with the kids, and the kids were really excited. You know, they just want to run around and eat as many noodles as they can and buy, you know, high panda toys, and like, yeah, get back in the car and be sick and then sleep for the rest of the evening, so it's worth it. And we're walking, there's a suspended bridge, wooden suspended bridge, again, traditional. It's very scary if you don't like heights. Oh, you can see it there. So you're entering into the room, and my hosts were going, oh, look at that, isn't it so beautiful? You know, finally, we've got a balance between traditional way of life and modernity. Because they're academics, and that's how academics speak to one another, even on shopping trips. And I was speechless, I couldn't say anything. I just thought, this is an abomination. And this, of course, has become the solution. If you are a multinational and you want to expand into China, what you do, you create fictional versions of traditional culture. You slap your logo on it, whether it's McDonald's, KFC, doesn't really matter. No one cares. It's all about sort of consumerism now, because consumerism keeps people quiet. So all over China, these ersatz kind of vulgarities are springing up in every urban center as a kind of nod to the desire to kind of return to traditional culture. Now, why should we? Sorry, I've gone on a bit. I'll finish now. Why should we even think about bothering returning to traditional culture in China? Well, I would argue that there is a wealth of irreplaceable knowledge embodied in their art, in terms of understanding self, in terms of understanding the physical world, that is going to go. It's like the energy gap. We know that we have to use industrial forms of energy to recreate the machinery that will allow us to cope with the lack of oil. And there's a short period of time in which we have to get the technology set up, because soon we won't have oil to run it. We won't be able to process metals in the same way. And then there's a culture gap here in China, where unless traditional ways of representing the world and thinking about the self are consolidated, then they'll be lost forever and irreplaceable. And this kind of way of thinking is not just relevant to Chinese culture. It has a relevance that goes above and beyond China. Last slide. More about it in this. Available at all good booksellers. And if it's not in your local library, please order it. Thank you very much.